from KPFK Pacifica Radio. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Across the United States, millions of school-age kids are returning to school after their winter break. But in the era of the pandemic, many are still connecting with teachers and classmates via remote digital platforms. Given the fact that digital technology was touted just a few years ago as a revolutionary educational tool, one might imagine that remote schooling would be a success. But the reality of using new technology has not lived up to its promise. My guest is Justin Reich. He is a Mitsui Career Development Professor of Comparative Media Studies and Director of the Teaching Systems Lab at MIT and the host of the podcast Teach Lab. He's written about education and technology for Education Week, The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The Washington Post, and Science. And his new book is called Failure to Disrupt: Why Technology Alone Can't Transform Education. Welcome to the program, Justin.
Sonali, thanks for having me.
So first, let's talk about the promise that was made and how and when it first emerged that people in the tech sector, who may or may not have been experts in education, touted technology, touted digital online learning as something that would completely revolutionize how kids learned, how even adults learned for that matter. Give me a thumbnail sketch of how that transpired.
Sure. Well, the risk of asking a historian that question is that we'll go way back. Certainly, we could point to people like Thomas Edison, who thought that film were going to revolutionize schools. People thought that radio, that the ability to broadcast great instructors from cities out into the countryside was going to revolutionize education. And so the folks of Silicon Valley in the 2000s and 2010s who picked up that mantle, they had a long tradition to draw from. And you might remember from your own education that film strips had not revolutionized schools when you were there. But hope springs eternal. There's a few people that we could point to. In 2009, the late business school professor Clayton Christensen wrote a book called Disrupting Class, in which he argued that by 2019, half of all secondary school classes would be taught online. They would cost a third as much to provision, and they would be better than traditional classrooms. Sal Khan in 2011, I think it was, gave a TED talk where he said, let's use video to reinvent education, about a century after Thomas Edison made a very similar argument about film strips. In 2012, the New York Times declared it the year of the MOOC. That was the year that massive open online courses offered by providers like edX and Coursera promised to revolutionize and democratize higher education. So there's been a lot of enthusiasm about the idea that, you know, if we could just get internet connected laptops and devices in the hands of young people, in the hands of learners, then there's this wealth of new technology, new resources that could transform their learning experiences.
And so school districts started taking that on, and taxpayer-funded iPads began to be distributed to kids around the country. And somehow I think this sense that putting an iPad in front of a child for many hours as they sat in a classroom would change the way they learned took hold. Were they just dazzled by new technology, or did that move to put iPads or tablets in kids' hands have any actual basis in pedagogy and studies?
You know, I have such mixed feelings about this. I ran a consultancy for a while, which worked with schools and districts, and we were actually quite in front of the iPad trend. And I'll say this about new: when you walk into a classroom where a teacher is using new technologies in very powerful ways that are well supported by their school community, I mean, the hairs on the back of your neck can stand up to see students connecting and collaborating with each other, with people beyond their classroom, to draw on all of the scholarly resources that appear on the internet. You know, I'm formerly a high school history teacher. When I was a seventh grade student myself, my teacher gave us a textbook on US history and a primary source reader with 30 documents from the Mayflower Compact to a letter from the Birmingham Jail. And that was the entire source material that we would use for the whole year. When I was teaching history in 2003, 2004, 2005, you know, the archives and governments and museums of the world were digitizing historical artifacts that were transforming the way that we could teach history. But What we find is that the most powerful possible implementations of new technology are rarely what you find in practice. Overwhelmingly, when teachers get access to new technologies, they use them to extend existing practices. They use technology to sort of do slightly more efficient digital versions of the things that they've done before. And that's not because teachers are lazy or don't understand technology or things like that. It's because really good teaching is incredibly hard, and it takes time, it takes practice, it takes professional learning support, it takes coaching. In too many places in the country, you know, when schools bought iPads, they would spend $500,000 on iPads and networks and connectivity. And then they would spend a few thousand dollars bringing in someone for a day to do professional development with the faculty on how to use them better. And not surprisingly, there wasn't a ton of innovation in many places that emerged from that kind of approach.
Now, it seems to me that a big part of the problem is that the same way in which an adult, you know, an 18-year-old and older person who has a basis in learning, how they use digital technology is quite different than a 5, 6, 10, or even 13-year-old child who has an iPad thrust in front of them and are basically, you know, told to scroll through figures or videos. Is that not a big factor?
Absolutely. And it probably isn't just age. One of the ways that psychologists describe it is an ability for self-regulated learning. That a lot of the online learning opportunities we create are really good at people who have really good executive function, who are really good at following through, at staying committed, at persisting at things. And, you know, interestingly, there's some evidence that the best way to develop really good self-regulated learning skills is through an apprenticeship in the formal education system. For many people, you become a really good online learner if you've had a lot of support and guidance in in-person schools in becoming that really good online learner. Now, of course, there are some precocious young people who are really good at that kind of self-directed independent learning. We don't know how big, but some portion of young people during the pandemic have thought that remote learning is great. You know, instead of being shuffled around every 52 minutes to a new class and told what to do in each period, there are folks who are finding, oh, you know, my teachers just give me like a list of things that I'm supposed to do, and I tackle them in my own order and my own way, and I like that much better. But that's absolutely the minority of young people. And even many adults find it very difficult to create the conditions and to have the self-regulated learning skills to be able to persist, particularly when we ask people to learn things that they aren't super sure that they want to learn, when we ask them to learn things that are part of a state-mandated curriculum. On the flip side, you know, as many adults probably recognize, adolescents are incredibly good at learning things online when they have a real passion for them. So young people are amazing at figuring out how to build new kinds of buildings in Minecraft, or following their hobbies, or makeup tutorials, or hair tutorials, or things like that. People are incredibly good at teaching themselves to write fan fiction or to code. You know, one of the great frustrations of watching online learning in school settings is that young people who are incredibly proficient at teaching themselves about things that they're passionate about online, they find it much, much harder to, you know, learn geometry in the Industrial Revolution and conjugating Mandarin verbs in the same way.
And so that shouldn't be surprising, though, right? Because if you have a state-mandated curriculum, you are trying to shove a traditional method of learning into a new method of learning and expect magic to just happen. And it has been found to not happen. You mentioned Salman Khan earlier. You cite in your book that he too admitted, although it's not as well known, that the promise that he thought technology would bring to learning did not transpire, because when you get down to brass tacks, it's a lot more complicated.
Yeah, Sal Khan is a great case study. He had an early, 2011-ish TED Talk called "Let's Use Video to Reinvent Education," where he made this argument that was something like, Let's put the entire math curriculum online as videos and digital practice problems. Let's let students work through it at their own individual pace. And then, you know, most of math kids can just kind of learn on their own from the computer, and teachers can spend their time either remediating kids who need more help or bringing groups of students together for rich project-based learning and enrichment and things like that. And in 2019, he gave a little interview, you know, certainly not read as many times as his TED Talk was watched, in a magazine called District Administration, which is this little like trade magazine for superintendents. And he said, well, actually, the things that we thought would work in theory, once we founded our own school, the Khan Lab School, they don't work nearly as well in practice. And he said, you know, now, instead of encouraging people to try to sort of reimagine teaching and learning of mathematics, we tell them, do your normal teaching 4 days a week and use Khan Academy 1 day a week as kind of supplemental practice problems. And he described that as the best of both worlds, something that was both doable and had some positive effects. I have a colleague, Morgan Ames, who wrote a great book called The Charisma Machine about the one laptop per child device that was kind of a precursor of the iPad phenom. And Morgan described two kinds of stances that people have towards education technology: the charismatic stance, this belief that new technologies can radically transform the future. And she contrasts that with the tinkerer's stance, which is technology can help, but it doesn't radically transform what we're doing. It helps us step by step through the long, slow, challenging process of making schools better by getting, you know, one of 1,000 things right every day. Part of what I try to do in my book is really celebrate that tinkerer's mindset, is to say it's not helpful to describe technology as revolutionary and transformative, nor is it helpful to describe it as, you know, impossible or useless. It's a set of tools that we can use that can make teaching and learning better, particularly if we support communities of educators in getting better at using new technology for teaching and learning.
Right. I mean, I imagine that if you ignore how learning actually happens, that important connection between teacher and student, or even between students and their peers, that may or may not happen through a screen, if you ignore that dynamic, and you reduce the technology to this magical tool, this transformational thing, then you forget how, you don't really pay attention to how education really happens. I mean, I'm not an expert, I'm simply a parent, but I have two young kids and I see how they learn. I see how they've had to transition to using tablets during the pandemic, and the older kid is thriving because, as you said, teenagers are really great at adopting this technology. The younger kid, not so much, because he really needs that personal interaction. And those things are based on biology, they're based on psychology, they're based on methods of teaching grounded in hundreds of years of educational experience. And it seems a big insult to all of that for, you know, the technocrats to come in and say, but the iPad will fix it all.
Yeah, I'm definitely not that enthusiastic about that kind of magical thinking. You know, to some extent, the education technology evangelists over the last two decades, their kind of baseline argument was, you know, we're only a few years away from having a new technology-mediated regime that's better than the existing education system. And when the pandemic, the pandemic sent 1.6 billion learners home for some form of interrupted schooling, and it was really the moment in which you might expect that education technology would come to save the day. But I think remote learning for most families, most students, has been somewhere between disappointing and disastrous. And we've learned how incredibly important it is, the peer relationships, the teacher-student relationships. And it's not that it's impossible to build those things online, but we're discovering all the ways that we took for granted how school buildings are very powerful places for those kinds of social interactions. You know, I think of a third grader, a third grader has a task that they're supposed to do that they're not that enthusiastic about. When she picks up her head in the classroom and looks around, there's a whole bunch of other kids who are doing what they're supposed to be doing. And she kind of catches the teacher's eye and the teacher gives a look like, "Hi, sweetie, what are you doing with your head up? Shouldn't your head be down working?" And the kid goes, "Okay, I'll go back to work." When that same third grader lifts up their head from their iPad at home, there's a refrigerator full of snacks over in the corner and there's a Nintendo Switch on the other side and there's this YouTube thing she could be watching. Schools have all kinds of mechanisms to help guide people to remain focused and persistent and motivated and supported. And it's so difficult for parents and students to be able to recreate that on their own at home.
Let's talk about how some of these technologies have certainly been positive. And one of the things you point out is that people, not necessarily just young people, but people of all ages, now have at their fingertips a wealth of information to teach themselves skills that we just didn't have before. I mean, you can learn to do all sorts of things by looking them up on the internet and watching somebody else do them and sort of teach yourself how to do them. You also have some efforts like you point out in your book, the Coursera catalog of very high level, college level courses that are available for almost free or free. Language learning apps like Duolingo. I admit I tried to learn Spanish on Duolingo and just rapidly got bored because I was staring at my phone all day instead of when I'd much rather prefer speaking to somebody in Spanish in person. So there are all sorts of ways in which these technologies have been helpful. You know, for example, if I needed to learn how to unclog my toilet, I could look that up on YouTube and figure that out. But something more long-term, like learning a new language, there's limits to that, right? So again, we should be looking at these new technologies as tools, but not as panaceas.
Yeah, I think education technology evangelists, they sometimes describe these technologies, I haven't found the right metaphor, but like Swiss Army knives or, you know, things that can kind of meet a whole wide range of teaching and learning challenges when they're actually more like very specific ratchet socket heads. They target, you know, they're good for certain subjects, but not others, for certain skills, but not others, for certain people, but not others. And if you imagine a whole sort of learning ecology, that might be okay. For you, learning Spanish on Duolingo didn't work out that well. There are, you know, millions of other people who did find that a productive way, almost exclusively to learn introductory Spanish. There's almost no one who really, you know, when you're learning to conjugate verbs or to pronounce words for the first time, an app is okay. When you're trying to, you know, read Don Quixote and make meaning of Spanish language and literature and culture, there's really not an app for that, or it's much more difficult to learn some of those kinds of things online. You know, if you're trying to design an education system to help millions and millions of people, you know, fulfill their personal development as best you can, there's all kinds of ways that you could say, let's take all the people who would benefit from a Spanish language learning app to get them started and let them have it and let them move forward that way. In a robust learning ecology, there'd be lots of other kinds of ways and opportunities. What really doesn't work well is when we say, now, you know, this whole swath of people will be able to learn this whole swath of things online, so we don't need to support in-person education, community education in the same way as we did in the past. There's lots of great applications for new technologies, and the challenge of education policy members, of community members who are coming together to design education in their own community, is to figure out sort of where these new kinds of tools fit in the context of also supporting a really robust in-person educational opportunities.
So we've talked a lot about how the technology has or hasn't impacted learners. What about educators? One of the main tasks of an educator is to assess how his or her student is learning, has learned or not. How has the new technology that we now have at our fingertips, that, you know, has been sold as this big promise, impacted educators and their ability to be good educators?
Sure. So, I mean, assessment is one great entry point into this discussion. If you want people to be able to learn somewhat independently, you've got to give them feedback on how they're learning. If you want to be able to, you know, send students to go use a math intelligent tutor for a while, the tutor has to be able to say, oh, you got that right and you got that wrong. And so you need to do this harder thing or this easier thing or need more help. And you know, computer scientists have partners with educators for as long as we've had computers, since the days that we had mainframe computers the size of your living room. People have been asking the question, how do we use computers to teach people? What we find is that computers are really good at assessing human performance when humans are sort of acting like computers. When humans do things that are routine, that are well-bounded, that have clear right or wrong answers, like computation in math, we've got some pretty good tools for automatically assessing people. So one of the sort of sets of tools that I think has been widely used during the pandemic has been, you know, sort of gamified adaptive math apps for elementary school in particular, things like Dreambox or ST Math or Khan Academy for Kids. And these things work pretty well. They provide some interesting challenges for students. They have little video and animated demonstration of how to do math. Kids can practice and try things and get feedback on whether they're doing it well or not. We don't have the same tools to evaluate how well students write. When students express themselves in natural language, it turns out that that's an extraordinarily challenging space to train machines to be able to sort of parse human language and human intentions. And so we don't have assessments that are very good at evaluating people's ability to reason from evidence. But reasoning from evidence is one of the main things that we teach in schools. So again, if you're a math teacher and you want to send your students home at night to do some practice problems and to get some automated feedback the next day about how they're doing, we have some pretty good technology tools for that. If you want to send students home to write a paragraph about how reading made them feel or what connections it helped them make to other literature, we don't have tools that can give them automated feedback about those kinds of things. So part of the challenge of integrating new technologies into teacher routines is being able to figure out, okay, these tools can be helpful here for these students in these circumstances, but not so much here in these other subjects, in these other circumstances.
And then any transition to digital technologies has a dark side, which is that, unfortunately, digital technologies are so good at gathering data that sometimes that data gathering can actually result in violations of people's privacy. And that's a big concern, especially when you're talking about little kids using tablets that gather data on how they use those tablets. What did you find in your book about that aspect of this education technology?
So there are risks and rewards to doing experiments and collecting data about people in online learning. And I'm an educational researcher. I've done a bunch of research on edX, where, you know, we've given millions of people experimental interventions and collected all kinds of data about their activity. In the best of all possible worlds, collecting that data and conducting experiments would let us do the, you know, what Amazon, what Google, what Facebook do when you show up to their websites, which is they conduct little experiments all the time to see how you interact with their environments. You know, for 1% of the time you go to Amazon, the buy button is green instead of red or whatever it is. And they can sort of figure out how they can most effectively, you know, part you from your money. We can use the same kind of techniques to figure out how to most efficiently and effectively help you learn math or how to conjugate Spanish verbs or other things like that. To do that, we have to conduct experiments on learners. We have to give some people one version of the app and other people another version of the app. And we have to collect a bunch of data about your learning experience. There are good, you know, as an educational research, I think conducting these experiments is great. It turns out that if you ask the public what they think of experimenting on young children's education, they're not nearly as enthusiastic as I am. So, you know, part of what we need to do is to continue to evaluate what are the potential rewards here. And I think we could look back over 20 years of educational research along these lines and see that we've learned a little bit about how to teach better, but no huge breakthroughs, nothing equivalent to the cure for cancer. And I also think we could say, well, there's been some, you know, data breaches and there's been some, you know, other kinds of sort of security risks, but there also hasn't been an event that we could point to where we could say, look at the tremendous harms that this group of students face directly from the release of their information. So we're at a moment where both, it's a risk-reward trade-off, but the risks and rewards themselves are not clear. Part of what I think we need to do in the field of education technology is be really engaged with the public around these questions and to, you know, ask people to contribute to conversations about, you know, what do you think is appropriate as we try to develop new tools that can help students learn better and faster and more effectively, more joyfully. But, you know, in order to do that, here are some of the ways that we're going to have to collect data and store it, conduct experiments, those kinds of things. There aren't easy answers to it.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Justin, for joining us today. Good luck to you with your book.
Thanks, Sonali.
My guest has been Justin Reich. He is the Mitsui Career Development Professor of Comparative Media Studies and Director of the Teaching Systems Lab at MIT. And the host of the podcast Teach Lab, he's written about education and technology for Education Week, The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The Washington Post, and Science. We've been talking about his new book, Failure to Disrupt, Why Technology Alone Can't Transform Education. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.